and welcome to Still Any Good,
the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Christopher Webb, and with Rob still away on paternity leave, I've managed to snaffle another very special guest. So let's say a big hello to broadcaster, journalist, and brilliant podcaster. It's Julia Rayside.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thanks for coming along. How's it going?
It's terrible. It's terrible. I'm on a sinking island run by a maniac, and it's terrible. How are you?
Well, I'm on a sinking island too, but ours is run by, I think, whatever the opposite of a maniac is, not a maniac.
We are so jealous in the UK of any video clip of Jacinda Ardern. We just sit and watch and cry. She is so capable and calm and compassionate, and we just want her here.
Tough shit, you can't have her. She's ours.
No!
For the benefit of our listeners, you're in London.
I am.
And of course, with us being in New Zealand, things are a little different at the moment. We are still technically under a level of lockdown, but we've been downgraded to level 2. The schools have been open for a week, so my kids have been back in school for a week.
Ah.
All of the shops are open.
Right.
You can get your hair cut if you want to, that kind of thing. Of course, that's not a problem for me. I let my kids do mine. It's great. I just give them the clippers and let them go for it. It's wonderful. I love it. But I'm still working from home, which is nice.
That's lovely.
I'm a government worker, but we have a front of house and they've decided we're not going to open
to
the public.
Oh, my God, stop. Have you met her?
No, I don't work in that. I work in a very unpopular government department. I'll say no more than that.
Oh, OK, you're a spy. Got you. OK, yeah.
That one. But no, as we've mentioned before, Rob has met her.
Oh, man. OK, well, I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to Rob. I want someone who's met her.
Well, we'll have to have you back on then.
Happy to do that. What does she smell like, Rob?
She smells of kindness and compassion.
I know.
So, obviously, you're saying it's not very nice. So what's sort of going on over there at the moment? We find it very hard to grasp what's going on there.
Well, as we record, we're just in the wake of Cummingsgate, as it's being called over here. So the government special advisor, Dominic Cummings, has been caught breaking lockdown. He basically was the architect of this whole thing in the first place. And he drove with his family a long way away to a second home owned by another member of his family because he suspected he and his wife both had coronavirus. So he took his suspected germs 260 miles across the country. Yep. He's been deflecting press criticism, public criticism ever since. And we've just had a long weekend, a bank holiday weekend here in the UK, where the press have, I mean, not very savagely, but the press have tried to go to town on him and take him to task. And he's just done like a wall of bullshit. Like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. Everything's fine. So there's a sense of, I mean, I haven't really been outside since, but there's we're on lockdown and there's a sense of people just going, fuck it then. Don't have to be on lockdown anymore. So the parks and beaches, and because it's very hot here at the moment, are just filling up with people going, don't care anymore. Yeah. Don't have to. I can interpret the rules. So things are bad politically. Everyone's very angry. I think it appears like nothing's going to happen. He won't face any consequences. I think that the public mood is shitty.
I did see a tweet today which said him driving to test his eyesight is like shitting your pants to see if you need to go to the toilet.
Yes, it's clearly a tissue of lies. It's horrible here. Can we all come there, please?
Well, we've got a spare room, so...
Yay!
come along. But anyway, speaking of, and I do love to do an awkward segue.
Good.
Speaking of coming to the Antipodean side of the world, it's your choice of film. So what have you chosen?
I have chosen a film I saw, and I can tell you exactly when I saw it, because there's a thing in the BBC Genome Project in this country where they've catalogued, I think, nearly 100 years of the Radio Times TV listings. So I can, that's all I had to do was put the title of this film into the Genome Project and it told me the date and time and channel. And so I could pretty much tell you where I was. But it's a 1998 film called Dead Letter Office.
Dear Dad, last night I had a dream. You came home and talked. When are you coming home?
When are you coming home?
Love from your bundle of joy.
Miss Walsh?
I've come about the job.
If you post something to the wrong place or without an address...
Insufficiently addressed.
Then it comes here, right? And you try to deliver it? What sort of letters are they?
Special cases, you know? To Jesus and dead people and ex-boyfriends. Written by desperados.
So they close their eyes and they fabricate another reality to survive.
What's wrong with that?
Rosa was wounded. But the children, they bled to death. That is my life.
I thought it was like destiny that I came here and I got the job. And I met you. And that you were the one who was going to fix up my life.
And it's an Australian film. And it was shown in the UK first. It's been shown quite a few times here, actually, according to the Genome Project. But I saw it in 1999, so a year after its release, on Sunday, the 28th of March at 10 p.m. on BBC Two.
BBC Two, okay,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, just to be
on
specific.
A Sunday,
yeah,
right.
It was
okay.
A Sunday evening. It was 10 o'clock, I'm guessing. I think I left home quite late because I'd been to university late. So I think I just left home. And I was probably, you know, looking for something to while away the hours. And I just happened upon this. And I fell in love, Chris, I did.
That's really nice. I'll be honest, I wasn't familiar with this film.
No, no one is.
I obviously had gone out on that Sunday night. Which is quite surprising, because being an Australian film, we do normally get quite a lot of Australian films on the telly over here.
Yes.
And they're quite well known, and because it's got quite a vibrant film industry. But
I don't even know how big it was in Australia, but the main actress in it, Miranda Otto, has sort of gone on to mm-hmm. do quite big things, and she's, you know, stars in lots of stuff in America. She's just been in Downhill with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and she also plays Sabrina's aunt in the remake of Sabrina the Teenage Witch with
the
girl who played the little girl in Mad Men. She's like Aunt Zelda in that. She's clearly went from Australia and then on to Hollywood and is doing really well. But so this is a film she made, well, obviously it's 20 years ago now. It's just a really sweet love story. Well, it's a story about sort of love and loss. And it's about her. She plays a girl called Alice. She's a bit directionless and lost. Her dad left when she was a baby. And she's always written letters to him, hoping they would find him. So romantic. Yes. And she addresses the letters, you know, to her dad, his last known address. And all the letters go through this place in the post office in Australia called the Dead Letter Office, where badly addressed mail gets sent and processed and then either returned to sender or whatever. And so she gets all these letters back and she's sort of clutched them all her life as a kind of, you know, a thing that connects her with her dad, even though he's never read the letters. And she always signed them from your bundle of joy. I know it sounds a bit schmaltzy, but bear with me because it is lovely. And anyway, one day her mum announces she's leaving. She's in a house share, in and out of jobs, in and out of terrible relationships with sort of loser boyfriends. And then a job comes up at the Dead Letter Office and she feels like it's fate. So she goes to work there.
That's right, yeah. So she turns up, she has an interview, and then that's when we meet kind of the office full of oddballs, if you like. There's four people that work there. So we've got Kevin, the pigeon man.
Yep.
His only friend is a homing pigeon, which they keep trying to deliver, but keeps flying back to the Dead Leper office, which is very
sweet.
Yes, I feel
like it might be a metaphor.
Yes, I did write that. My note does say, is the pigeon's name metaphor? which is a good name for a pigeon.
Yeah.
We have Mary, the Indian lady, and she's desperate for her nephew, Victor, to have the job.
That's right, yeah.
So she's trying to push Alice out of the office and say, well, the job's already been taken.
Yeah.
Then we get Peter. He's the one who likes the dead letter, saucy postcards.
He's a porn-obsessed arsehole, from what I can tell.
He is, yeah.
He's the only not nice character in this whole thing, basically.
Now, when I first saw him, I thought it was Chris Lilley, but clearly it isn't because it's about 20-odd years ago and he's not wearing brown face.
No, exactly. Oh, God, I know. But he does look like he's wearing a wig. He probably isn't. It's probably just a dodgy haircut. But it's the kind of dodgy haircut that says wig.
That's right. And it's Peter who he's leaving. So she's supposed to be replacing him. She's filling in his vacancy because he, like all people in Australian dramas, is going to Brizzy.
He's going to Brizzy.
Which is what happens to everybody in Neighbours.
Everyone in Neighbours. Incidentally, Miranda Otto, it turns out, I only found out this today after researching, you know, what happened to, she ended up marrying Shane from Neighbours.
Shane, that's right.
Peter O'Brien. So they're, I think they're in Hollywood together, I think.
They are,
being all married and successful and Australians in America. But yes, how lovely.
I know it's slightly misogynist to talk about actresses and then immediately say, oh, they're married to. But yeah, I had to bring up the fact she's married to Shane.
Oh, no. It's exciting when it's someone from Neighbours because that's completely legit. Yeah. That's totally fine.
Sure. Yeah, and the other one in the office is Frank.
Yes.
Frank is the office manager.
Frank.
He's very sad. He curses in Spanish. And he is Father Mike from Frasier.
Right, okay. So and also, apparently, at the moment, he's just finished a run in Days of Our Lives. So clearly, he's done okay in America as well. But I haven't seen him anything since, apart from that. But he's an actor called George Del Hoyo. I think he's born in somewhere
in
like
Uruguay.
Oh, you've done your research.
I have. I do my homework.
But he plays a Chilean man in this. He's basically has a dark, sad past. He has a sadness within. He's beautiful. I remember thinking that at the time, and I still think it, quite frankly. He is just beautiful. And he's just got that faraway look of someone who prefers to be alone because he doesn't want to talk about it. Thanks. And obviously, there's a mystery, and immediately she's drawn to him.
Yes, absolutely.
Her new boss.
He's very, very interesting. Very enigmatic, isn't
mm-hmm.
he? Yes.
Yeah.
So then we go back to Alice's strange flat here, which you mentioned before.
Yeah.
Which is another room full of misfits, another room of people who don't really belong.
Mm-hmm.
And then I couldn't really work out this floppy-haired child that walks into her room. Is he her boyfriend, or does she just kind of immediately seduce him because she's bored? I couldn't really work it out.
I couldn't work it out either. And then when he kept turning up, I had sort of forgotten him. But he is this sort of floppy-haired surfer dude who has no real part in the film. He's just kind of like a demonstration of how low her expectations are romantically, that she'll just sort of fall into bed with some random floppy-haired dude. And that's being unkind. There's nothing awful about him. He's just sort of a bit nothingy. And she clearly has no interest in him. And she's actually quite horrible to him when he's sort of trying to get her attention when she starts researching Chile because she's passionately in love with her boss later in the film. She just sort of doesn't answer his questions and dismisses him. And he just looks sad. He's there to look rejected. And that is the end of his role. Sorry.
Yeah, he's just a little bit boring. And he is, I mean, he's not literally a child because it's not that sort of film. But he acts like a child. There's a bit where they're sitting together on the beach and he throws some stones at some seagulls. And she asks him why. And he says, oh, I just wanted to appear macho. So he's just an idiot trying to impress her, basically. Yeah,
and then he says, did that put you off? And she's just like, yeah. Like, I don't think I could be put off at this point. I don't think we're even there, mate. Sorry. No. Yes, it's not clear why he's with him apart from she doesn't like herself enough to have a nice relationship. But there we go.
Yeah. But luckily, her interview went well and she's got the job. And mainly it's because she'd mentioned in her interview that she used to be a dancer. And Frank is interested in this for some reason. He's interested in the dance.
That's right. Dancing is something. They have something in common. Right at the beginning of the film, it begins with a little girl in a ballet class.
Yes.
And then I think writing to her dad to tell him about her ballet class, because clearly by that point, he's buggered off.
That's right.
And we get an inkling later, the further into the film we get, the two of them get to know each other. And it becomes apparent that Frank also had a passion for dance. But when she says, go on, do a bit, he's like, no. And he gets really angry and storms off, because clearly it brings back memories of the old country.
Yeah, because he tells her he's almost like a dancing cowboy. In a Chilean dance
room. It's amazing.
It's a bit Village People.
There's something he's not telling her about his past in Chile.
Absolutely.
We were a tribute act. It was, I needed the money, yeah.
If I had done my homework, I would have translated what Village People is in Spanish and just said that now, but I haven't, unfortunately.
How you say YMCA?
That's right.
That is not a good Chilean accent. I apologise. But anyway, so yeah, she starts working at the Dead Letter office. And initially there's a bit of grit in the oyster because those two characters you mentioned, Mary's again her because she wanted her nephew to work there. And when Alice takes the job, she doesn't like her. And then I'm going to call him Pawny Guy. He doesn't deserve a name. Pawny Guy is also quite rude to her. And she realises there's one corner of the office that's like special projects, the special category.
Yeah, special cases. Yeah.
Which are kind of filed in a box. And she wants to look inside the box. And she basically wants to connect with these other lost voices in the shadows who are kind of all writing to people who could never write back. Some of them are writing to God or a dead lover. Or there's just the less sympathetic characters say a lot of desperate people. But they're just a lot of lost people looking for something and writing it
down. Absolutely.
It's lovely. It's so poetic.
Yeah, which of course Alice connects with because she is one of those people too.
She's a dreamer.
That was good.
Thanks very much. I watched a lot of Neighbours when I was young.
Same here. I was one of the generation of Neighbours that bunked off school, so it caused Neighbours to then be broadcast at a slightly later time. I was in the sixth form when all of that happened.
Yes.
So we used to bunk off in the afternoon to watch Neighbours.
I used to watch it with my dad. He got made redundant when I was probably around sixth form. And so he was suddenly at home a lot and I was maybe home studying or whatever. And we used to sit and guiltily watch Neighbours at lunchtime. It was like the greatest joy. And he became quite involved in the plots. It was amazing.
You were never truly a Neighbours fan unless you watched both viewings.
On the same day,
You'd have to watch the first one and the second one.
For sure.
Then there's a scene that I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah.
It's that scene where Frank does the 10-minute test.
He times the tracing of a letter.
I love stuff like this, where they set the clock and they go, right, let's do it. And they use all their skills, all their smarts, which is looking at a microfiche.
Oh, I love it. This whole thing is like the Industrial Revolution. It's like the coming of the bots, because you're watching a kind of a moribund sort of department in the postal service slowly dying. As the film goes on, they slowly start to take bits of the office away because they're rationalising it, because they're going to introduce computers. The thing that they have in 1998 in the Dead Letter Office is a computer. They have, like you said, microfiche machines. They have phone directories. They don't have computers. And actually, when I first started work, it was around this time, 1999, in London, I worked as a TV researcher, and we didn't have the internet in the office. Mm. We had a Yellow Pages. Like, I worked on a documentary, it's very grand. I worked on ITV shows about, like, oh, my wedding day went wrong. And we'd try and find footage of, like, brides falling over, grooms being sick or whatever. And you'd have to do it by going through the Yellow Pages and, like, looking up wedding photographers and just phoning around going, have you got any funny videos, mate? It was insane to think that that's what it was like, but it was.
I always remember when I first saw You've Been Framed, when I saw the very first episode, it was a revelation.
Absolutely.
It's amazing to think that that was 25 or 30 years ago. That,
I know.
God, some people have got this sort of thing on home video.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, my son still loves that show now. We used to call it Falling Down Programme when he was very small. And now when it's on, I'll still go, Doug, Falling Down Programme's on. And he'll just go, it's not called that. It's not called that, Mum. It is.
It is. We used to call it You've Been Hurt, which I think is probably still fair. But even watching You've Been Framed compared to... I've got kids. My daughter's 9, so she watches a lot of these things on YouTube. Yeah. And they're always called Try Not to Laugh.
That's it.
It's a piece of piss, because none of them are funny.
No, they're really not.
There's no effort in not laughing.
No, not at all.
They're dreadful.
Although Falling Down Programme has caused much amusement in this house, I still hide my eyes every time I know that someone's going to get actually hurt. Because I don't want to watch that. I don't want to watch that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's funny.
When you see heads on concrete and things like
by
swimming pools, it's horrific. It's horrendous.
Back to the film, though.
But there's none of that in this. So, yes, they're doing that 10-minute test, which is quite bizarrely probably slightly less time than it took us to talk about You've Been Framed. But they're looking at the microfiche. They're looking at Rego's, which we do say.
You do.
I say Rego. Yeah. I feel like a right prick when I go and have to renew my Rego.
Look, you've got to fit in, okay? You don't want to just, like, smoke you out and realise you're not from there.
It's like me calling somebody dude or stuff like that. Or
mate.
More telling nostalgia when Simon Groom tried a CB radio on Blue Peter.
Oh.
And he was talking about Smokies and all this sort of stuff. It's got that kind of parochial feel to it.
You shouldn't have said Simon Groom. We are never going to get round to the film, because now I have to tell you the time I stayed at Simon Groom's house.
In Dethick?
Yes! He still lives there, and I don't know if it's still a thing, but up until very recently, he runs the farm, his dad's farm in Dethick. This is Blue Peter Simon Groom from the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
He runs the farm with his wife, Jilly, as a bed and breakfast.
Wow.
I know this because I was on Twitter, and no less than Janet Ellis, who by now we started following each other, I worship her, I was asking where I could go on holiday in Derbyshire because we had friends up there. I was like, we're going to stay nearby and visit them. And she said, oh, you must stay at Simon's farm, and I nearly passed out. So then she gave me the details. I got in touch. We got mates rates.
Because Janet said it would be okay.
Yes. And it was genuinely idyllic. It is the most beautiful place on earth. Just so lovely. And we stayed there for a couple
amazing.
Of nights. And it's, yes, Simon Groom. Wonderful. He told me where to buy antiques in Matlock. And I took him up on it. In fact, I'm sitting here now with my desk looking at a wooden box I bought at the antique shop he recommended. That's my Simon Groom story. Thank you.
That's fantastic. I'm never going to be able to top that. That's incredible. We'll just stop now and talk about Simon Groom.
Forget it. The 10-minute test, Chris.
Yes, they're still trying to find the recipient of this letter. So they've moved on from Rego's phone books.
Yeah.
They actually make the job look quite fun rather than the mind-numbing mundanity that it probably was in real life.
Yeah, they make it look like detective work, and they're sort of all... What it's trying to establish is that somewhere in that hard exterior, Frank's got a real passion for this. Like, he likes to be good at his job, and he likes to... Although he pretends not to have any emotional connection with the people in the letters, he likes solving problems for them. He likes helping people. And so it's a really nice, everyone sort of unites as a gang. It's almost like she's found the dysfunctional family she's always been looking for, kind of, sort of. It's lovely.
Yeah. So once they found that, which works brilliantly, the metaphorical pigeon turns up again.
He does.
And Frank drops him off to its rightful owner again.
Which he does every night. He takes him a little cardboard box and leaves him outside the door.
But of course, the next day, he comes back to hang out with him, which Kevin is very pleased with.
And it's the delightful detail of just they make a little nest for him in one of the pigeon holes. I've just realised that's what they're called.
Wow.
Doing! Where they keep the letters. I know, right? Like, it didn't even occur to me till just then. How thick am I?
That's amazing.
But they put some straw in one of the pigeonholes so he can have a little sit down when he's not flying around the rafters delightfully.
As pigeons do.
The moments in this film where I really like, there's lots of poignant little extracts where, so by this time, Alice's curiosity's got the better of her and she takes some of the special cases letters home because she wants to understand these other people who've written to no one, to nothing. And there's really lovely moments where you can hear the voices of the people who've written the sad letters.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's to someone who's died or left them or God or the universe. But it's just that these lovely sort of lost voices just sort of trickling onto the soundtrack. It's just really poignant. And
It is nice, yeah. And then she gets a little bit interested in one of the letter writers.
Yes, Carmen.
Carmen, who's writing to Juan. Mm-hmm. It's about a lost love and the letters are very romantic and very heartfelt. So she finds that very interesting. And then Carmen kind of becomes her little project.
She reads in one of in that letter from Carmen, she reads into the lines in the letters that Carmen's actually genuinely quite desperate without this lost one who's gone somewhere. He was the one and now he's gone. So she's very sad. I'm so sorry. But she's so sad to the point that she said, oh, to close my eyes forever would be lovely. And Alice worries that she might be suicidal. So she makes it her business to find Carmen, which she does.
Yes. But of course, Frank says, leave it. That's not your job. You shouldn't really be doing that kind of thing. What business do you have trampling over people's feelings like
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
He's kind of got a point.
He kind of does have a point. She can't play God. She can't sort of intervene and start moving people around like chess pieces. But the tension between the two of them is they sort of seem to like each other, but he doesn't seem to like anyone. He's more feared than liked. He's very other. He's separate from the rest of the little dysfunctional gang. Apart from in that nice little 10-minute thing, he stays separate.
Yeah, he's so much so about how separate he is that his desk is just slap bang in the middle of an empty room.
Yes, because it looks cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
One angle poise, one lone desk. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah. Then again, it signifies how separate he is from everybody else. But Alice has obviously been impressed by their finding techniques. And so she tries to do the same to find her father. So she looks at the microfiche, going to his last known address. And she meets a gardening lady who then immediately puts in a complaint saying, why is the dead letter office coming around here?
That's right, because she uses the uniform and an official clipboard to look like she's sort of proper. And then there's a complaint about her and Frank tears her a new one. There's a lot of tension in their relationship whenever she oversteps the mark because she's thinking with her heart, not her head. Because he's an older man and he tells her off like a dad.
Yes.
It's a bit worrying. I mean, clearly she has got a dad thing. Her dad's gone.
Yeah.
She fancies older men. Mm. We'll just have to accept that and move on. And he does. He tells her off several times. And she sort of is like an admonished child. She thinks she's disappointed him, upset him, and it really crushes her. Because you can't just have two people who seem quite attractive and into each other just get together. So there's a lot of will they, won't they, because he seems quite angry with her a lot of the time. So, you know, how could he love her?
But there are a lot of very nice sparks going through as well. There are those times where he's telling her off and she's not happy with him, but very subtle and very, very delicate ways that they show their attraction to each other. There's a bit where she spills a coffee and he gives her a quick rub down with a tea towel.
Just her
which
hands.
Is very nice.
Don't make it. Don't cheapen this. Don't cheapen this. But it's lovely. In the way that, I don't know if you've seen Normal People yet, is it a global phenomenon or just an English and American phenomenon?
We've got it here on TVNZ On Demand. We have it on here on our own streaming service.
Okay. So it's basically a similar deal. When I saw this, I so invested in these two as a couple. I was so, like, it almost gave me a tension headache how much I wanted them to get together by the end of the film. It's exactly the same way I think people are responding to Normal People now, is that you see these two people who, for some reason, you can't really articulate, you just need them to be together. And it's what drives the whole thing from the beginning. Yeah. As soon as they meet, as soon as she starts to find him interesting, I'm like, get together. Oh my God, get together. Yeah. Oh my God, why aren't you together yet? I would have exploded or punched the TV if they hadn't gotten together. I'm sorry, I'm spoiling it, but
that's okay.
I would have gone, absolutely. But we're not there yet. We're not there yet.
But it is very nice to be invested in a couple in a romantic film, because there are so many where you think, why the hell would they like each other? And I don't really want them to be together. Normally because he's a prick. One of the things that we reviewed for this a little while ago was Sliding Doors.
Oh, yes. And,
both men in it are just absolute bellends.
Dreadful, dreadful people.
Just go it alone.
No, I have endless conversations. Well, not endless. I mean, we've tried to stop going on about it now. My husband and I, caving to pressure, maybe a year after it came out, we watched Bridesmaids.
Oh, yeah.
Because everyone was saying, oh, my God, it's like amazing. I don't know why it immediately annoyed me that she ran a cake shop. Everything about it was like, oh, shut up. Why do people like this? Then all the gross out stuff that didn't seem to have any basis in anything. Mm. And then at the end, she gets together with a prick. He's a prick. He's supposed to be like the nice guy, but the character Chris O'Dowd plays is a prick. I don't understand. Yeah, sometimes it's the wrong couple and I can't invest.
Yeah.
But in this couple, I wholeheartedly, it should be wrong. He's older, he's troubled, terrible things have happened to him in Chile, and she's just, you know, directionless and looking for a father figure. Uh-oh. But yeah. Somehow it works.
Yeah.
It's
because they're both lovely. They're just
they're
both really
super
nice.
Attractive as well. Yeah. Super sexy.
It helps.
Yeah. So he explains that he used to dance dressed as a cowboy. That doesn't put her off.
Yeah.
She's still into it. But then she says, go on then, do a little dance now. And he clams up and says, no, and kind of snaps at her.
Mm.
And she looks like sort of embarrassed and she kind of scuttles off. So he keeps on kind of scaring her off by going, boo, and she runs away.
Yeah, that's right.
But it becomes apparent.
No.
No, exactly. No. Yeah. But it becomes apparent that he doesn't elucidate further, but he is a father. But he no longer sees his children.
That's right.
And so obviously that's something that really chimes with her, because she's been in search of her dad since she was a child. So that kind of adds a little bit of tension, like, oh, you don't see your kids. That doesn't sound so good. Obviously later we find out why. It's awful.
It's not very nice, yeah. Yeah.
No, it's really not. But in that moment, she starts to have an effect on him and she says something about the pigeon. The pigeon clearly wants to be with you. Why don't you stop leaving it with its owner? Why don't you just take it home, take responsibility for it? And clearly, he can't be a father to anything, let alone a pigeon, because terrible things have happened in Chile.
That's right.
But he does. He takes the pigeon home. And there begins his path to healing, Chris.
Yes, that's his beginning of moving on, isn't it? Because he takes the pigeon home. The pigeon kind of gets out of his box. So to try and catch him, he puts on some panpipe moods in the background.
Chilean panpipes, the music of the mountains.
That's right.
So lovely.
It's wonderful. And so then he's running around the living room trying to catch the pigeon. So it's almost like a Latino Dick Dastardly sort of running around his living room.
Now I'm thinking, panpipes catch the pigeon. Do, 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 do. Yeah. That would have been cool. But I wrote in red, she is having an effect on him. So somehow, even though he resists, his heart is beginning to open. And yeah, he listens to the music of home, which maybe it suggests he hasn't done that for a while because he doesn't want to think about home. He's got like a couple of straw donkeys on the side, but other than that, you wouldn't know he was from Chile.
He's got one of those bullfighting posters with his name printed on it.
Oh, I really want one of those. If you could find out where to get them, I do really want one.
My dad had one of those when we went to Spain in the late 70s.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
That is cool,
yeah.
Genuinely.
We never went to a bullfight because that's fucking horrible.
Oh, no, I mean, I don't like bullfights as a thing, but that artwork, I love it.
Of course, it was in the toilet. We're all Spanish bullfighting posters, guys.
Sweet.
And now he lives in Spain.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
What have you all got against the UK, apart from the obvious?
Oh, my brother's still in. My brother lives in Sheffield.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
So, yeah, Alice, of course, now she's having an effect on Frank, but she's also realised what the dead letter office and the special cases files are about.
Yep.
So she gets a bit clever and she writes another letter, knowing full well that it's going to come to the dead letter office.
Exactly.
And so she sticks it in that special cases file.
With all the resources that it has.
That's right. And Frank has kind of allowed her not to just chuck them in a drawer. He said, well, if you want to follow them up, you go for it. You file them. You sort it out.
So she's clever, but because they've discussed dancing as a thing that kind of joins them together, and she'd been thinking about how she used to do ballet when she's a little girl. I like the detail of her going to the very scenically placed postbox.
Oh, yes.
It's on the seashore, just in front of the seashore, with the sun setting behind it. And she posts the letter in kind of a ballet arabesque, like she slam dunks it into the slot doing a ballet pose, which I thought was very sweet.
It was very nice.
But also says that he's awoken something about her younger self in her too. So they're kind of bringing each other to life in a really lovely way. I think I might have read too much into this, but I don't care. I love this film. Can you tell I love this film?
No, you've read into that very well. That's very impressive.
I think so. I did do film studies. I know it shows. But then you go to a village hall where there's some kind of Chilean expat knees up going on. People are dancing with handkerchiefs over their heads in a most unusual, not Morris dancing manner. But clearly it's like, it's a Chile thing. And he sees two of his old friends there, Lucia and Vincente, and they, I think quite subtly and brilliantly, provide some of his backstory for us. So they haven't seen him for ages. He's been hiding away. We don't know how long he's been there, but they mention Rosa, who is clearly the wife he left behind in Chile.
That's right.
And then they take him to the church, presumably next door to the church hall, and it's all dark and lit with lots of candles. And they talk about praying for his children and his wife and lighting candles. And obviously he just looks very, very, very sad. He's very sad.
Yes.
No one could look sadder. But now we get some impression of there's a great sadness in his life and we don't quite know what it is. Because I'd forgotten what it was. And then when it did actually come later in the film, I was like, oh, my God, I didn't remember it being that. Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of hinted at because we see like a photo of the kids in his drawer, which he doesn't take out. So he doesn't have this photograph on show.
No.
And things like the lighting of the candles, that obviously represents what we think it represents.
Well, yes, exactly. But I was still not quite, I hadn't quite gotten there.
No.
Then we go back to the dead letter office. He often works late. She started to work late too, because I think she just feels like it's nice to be with him alone, even if they don't necessarily, they're just doing their jobs. There's a really lovely thing about them just wanting to be in the same place at the same time. And she comes past the door of his improbably large office with a desk and a spotlight in the centre. And he's doing some Chilean dancing, just like on the spot, kind of stamping and hanky twisting.
That's right.
On his own.
Like a child on TikTok. Do a lot of that.
Yes. It's a slightly more poetic version of that. And there's no dreadful music playing in the background. He's just doing it in silence. Then I think there is some like Spanish guitar on the soundtrack that kind of, it just hints that he doesn't say anything and he just sits down at his desk, but passions within him are stirring.
Absolutely.
Something's going on in there. He's a churning mass of stuff.
And it seems to be doing the same for Alice too, because she's watching him and kind of, oh, hello. She's intrigued.
I mean, let's face it, he looks fit. He's stamping about and he manages to make twirling a hanky above his head look incredibly masculine and really quite hot. Then I've just written metaphor homing pigeon, because I think there's another heavy-handed thing about the pigeon coming back.
Yes. Yeah, because he builds a coop for the pigeon.
That's right, in his back garden.
So it won't, I would say, run away. So it doesn't fly away. He wants to keep the pigeon with him. So he
wants to give
coop.
It a home. It's like Australia's given him a home. He's going to give the pigeon a home. I might be reading too much into it again. before we leave them, so she's seen him dancing, but she doesn't announce herself and she scuttles away, sort of not wanting to know that she's seen. Because she knows he'll probably react angrily. But then later on, either that night or another night, they're working late again together and he thinks she's gone home and he's about to turn the lights off and then realises she's just coming back from getting them a coffee and a samosa. Mm.
Some samosas, yeah.
Do you like samosas? I've used that line before. It always works, let me tell you. Never fails. But because he turned the lights off, she spills hot coffee all over her hand. And that's when he delicately mops her hand and they both sort of go, this is a bit sexy, but no one says anything. And it's all a bit like, oh, my God, tension. That's when the tension headache really kicked in. And then it just for the rest of the film, it's like, kiss, 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 kiss. Will you please get on and kiss? It drove me mad. But yeah, they stay late a lot and work together. And meanwhile, I think her letter has arrived at the office and she's included the photograph of her dad back to the camera, holding her with his car just further off in the background, because she's hoping the picture maybe will get the letter to the top of the pile. And then they have this really, really soul-destroying conversation that kind of completely severs any rapport they were getting. And she says to him, why don't you like these letters? And he just says, they are futile. And basically just crushes all thought of anyone ever getting back what they've lost. Because once you've, very poignantly, once you've lost it, that's it, it's gone and you shouldn't try and get it back. He just basically might as well have ripped up the letter in front of her and just gone there and thrown it in her face.
Yeah, because he's saying there's no hope. He says they are submarina.
Yes, submarino. It's like what they say in Chile, you're living underwater if you're living in this idea that there's a brighter tomorrow. You're like, you basically forget it.
Yes.
So saying a lot about his mental state. She's utterly distraught and just picks up her bag and tearfully leaves. And you're like, no, no, Frank, go after her.
That's not right.
But then he does go home and build a pigeon coop. So clearly he's still, thinking about her. And she goes home to her weedy boyfriend, who she shows no interest in whatsoever. And you just, I mean, he is deeply unattractive, but you also do feel kind of sorry for him. He might as well not be there.
Yeah, she's giving out mixed signals, really, isn't she?
Mixed signals. She's got her back to him and she literally can't hear a word he's saying. I think she's reading something. And then back at the office, Frank starts to read the special cases. So he's been dismissing her quest and to help people and the letters themselves as written by desperate people. He starts to read them. And there's this lovely little cutaway of like a graphic of like pieces of paper floating in space.
That's right.
Fluttering about. Yeah. Just so sweet and so lovely. And so sort of an extra thing the director didn't need to do, but thought, no, I'll do a visual representation of these lost pieces of paper blowing in the wind instead of a twinkly sky. It's just lovely. And then what happens then? So her letter then reaches the top of the pile at the Dead Letter Office. Meanwhile, she's tracked down Carmen from the sad letter, the woman who wants to close her eyes forever and go to sleep. Obviously, Carmen is very wise and is incredible and they are immediately friends. I'm sorry for the accents, really. I can't help myself. But she says very wisely and very sort of pointedly, nobody can stop you from yearning. So she can see that in Alice, there's a yearning, there's something that's missing. And that's what Alice probably liked in her letters. And so that establishes the two women are kind of in touch. They're talking. And then rain, pathetic fallacy, the Dead Letter Office. And then so the rain's pouring down. Alice and Frank aren't talking to each other. Their relationship's in tatters. Slowly but surely, officials keep coming in and putting stickers on things, hinting that the office is going to be dismantled and packed up and taken away. And then I wrote in red letters. Chris, you know that I do a podcast called Always There about Howard's Way.
Yes, I do. Very much so.
What is the name of Alice's father, who she's trying to trace?
He's called Gerald Urquhart.
So there's a character in her. This is, I wrote it because I was like, how did I not realise this? So there's a character in Howard's Way who's he's in a lavender marriage with a woman called Polly. He's a gay man from the 80s who works for a big business man called Charles Freer. He's called Gerald Urquhart. He's got the same name.
My God.
I didn't make the connection. It's completely mad.
No wonder you're obsessed.
Well, I mean, it just feels like the universe keeps on like hitting me on the head with this stuff. Yeah, so clearly.
That's unbelievable.
This film stuck in my brain. That might have been one of the reasons because that name obviously just goes in and stays. But amazing.
As you know, I'm a big fan of Howard's Way. I've Always There. I have listened to every single episode.
Yay!
And that never even occurred to me.
Right, I know.
Mainly because there's a New Zealand actor called Gerald Urquhart.
Oh, is there?
Who used to be in Shortland Street.
Oh, I loved Shortland Street. I didn't even realise there's another Gerald Urquhart. Wow.
He played Dr. Luke Derville.
Nice. Nice info.
He died.
I'm sorry for your loss. But how cool is that? Anyway, I just love the symmetry of that same name.
That is brilliant.
But meanwhile, so Frank has decided, clearly he feels bad for destroying her innocent hope for the future and decides to make her letter a special case. I still don't think he knows it's her that's written it because she just signs it from your bundle of joy. But yes. I think he's sort of, I don't know, there seems to be an inkling there. And meanwhile, Mary in the office, who's now warmed to Alice and is being much more friendly and maternal towards her, she can see that they've had a tiff and fallen out. Then Alice sees that Frank is looking at her letter in particular and comes and brings him a cup of tea as a peace offering. Mary notices there's been a falling out and a reconciliation. I think she suspects that Alice likes Frank. And she tells him, you could never hope to understand such a man. So she kind of is saying, you know, don't go there, girlfriend. He's like, well, complicated and like, stay back.
Yeah, he's had a bit of a hard time. You might want to leave it. Yeah,
exactly. She mentions Chile again. There's an ever-present photograph, a big picture on the wall of the office of the mountains of Chile, the mountain range
Yes.
Is it the Andes? My geography is absolutely terrible.
Yes, it is the Andes.
Probably the Andes. So she then becomes obsessed with Chile and she goes home and we see like her reading books about what happened in Chile, which she's quickly obtained, presumably from the local library.
Well, they didn't have computers to look things up, did they? So they had
to go
to
the library. Didn't. No, so she has a bunch of reference books, which is a bit creepy. And again, another reason for her to ignore her boyfriend, who's just lying there going, what are you doing? And she's just like, shh, reading about Chile. What, again?
Although she does ask him if anything terrible has ever happened to him. And he gives her a jokey answer.
Yeah.
And this just offends her for no reason that he's ever going to understand.
Yeah, wrong answer. Yeah.
He just sort of says, oh, can you ask me again then, please?
Yeah, I know. He's so pathetic. I don't. I mean, I sort of feel a bit sorry for him, but not really.
No, I think he is very, very childlike. I think she wants a man, not a boy who thinks he can.
I think you've judged her quite well, though.
Which is very wise words.
Meanwhile,
yeah.
So she's back on speaking terms with Frank, and she asks him why he came to Australia. And he says he flipped a coin and it was Canada, Australia, and Australia won. He said it was a random choice. Then he mentions there's Chilean independence celebrations, presumably at this same venue that he saw his friends at recently. And she basically invites herself. She's like, can anyone come?
Can anyone come?
It's like, okay, I would wait to be asked, although I realise he's quite a reticent man and maybe you'd be waiting a long time. But maybe just wait for him to say, I could bring a friend or a bit. She invites herself. And the next thing you know, she's dressed up in some insanely gorgeous red dress, looking like a Hollywood starlet. Like, she looks incredible.
Yeah.
Like, just absolutely perfect. This lovely red silk dress and hair's all done, makeup, high heels, the work. She looks incredible. And they kind of see each other across the room. There's dancing going on. It's really full. There's a big band, laughing children. It's the works. Mm. It's the full big party film tropes cliches. And then they see each other and he says, you look beautiful. And she's like, oh, I never wear dresses, because we always see her in like sort of cash clothes.
Exactly.
It's like, seriously, that's designer. It's beautiful. You look incredible. And then Vincente's wife immediately sort of bundles her off to get a drink and then dance and sort of, you know, wants to meet her and know all about her. And then Vincente says to Frank, oh, maybe it's time for a new woman. And Frank just sort of smiles but doesn't say anything. You think, oh, my God, he's actually warming to the idea of this as a possible relationship. Tension headache by now is just like boom, boom, boom.
Because he was clearly wowed by her. As she comes in, he does actually say, you look beautiful.
Yeah, and she does.
Yeah, and that's when his friend says, you know, he effectively says, you know, it's time to fill your boots.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I'm not putting it too politely, yes.
No, but it's in Spanish, so... It'll be Diana tus boatas.
I will take your
I did look that one up.
Did you really? That's cheating. Okay.
I looked up fill your boots on Google Translate. Yep.
Wowza. I am impressed.
We do proper research on this show, I'm telling you.
I should have looked up, do you like samosas?
So they salsa together.
Well, he says he's going to teach her to salsa, which is even more like, ooh, vibes, because that's another teacher-pupil thing. It's another grown-up child. It's that dynamic is like it's very ever-present. So he teaches her to salsa. It's going really well.
He does lie to her, though. He says it's very easy. It bloody isn't.
No, salsa's like the hardest one on Strictly, isn't it?
I used to go to salsa classes. It's really hard.
Did you? I don't think I could ever get that motion going with my... No. It's impossible.
And I've learned ballroom, but I can't do it. I can't do salsa. It's so difficult.
Have you now?
Yeah. I went to a school where our Christmas ball was ballroom dancing.
Holy wow. Jesus.
It wasn't like Eton or anything like that. It was a normal school.
Okay.
We had to learn like the waltz and the foxtrot.
That's cool.
The dashing white sergeant, all of this stuff. It was great.
That's not a thing, Chris.
Yeah, that was the man who taught me. Yeah.
Okay, moving on quickly. Getting to this. He says, I will teach you to salsa. And then he says, let my hands guide you. I passed out then. So what happened in the rest of the film?
That's where it ended.
Then they go outside and he says to her quite pointedly, the next song will be slow. Like, here we go, baby. It's the time we kind of, you know... And then Carmen shows up. She's invited Carmen. And this confused me because I'd forgotten she has ostensibly invited Carmen as a kind of possible date for Frank.
Yeah.
And Carmen's gorgeous. Like, don't do that, you idiot. He'll probably fancy her. Luckily, Carmen's a massive racist, so it's all fine.
She's a big fascist. It's okay.
It turns out she's Argentinian. Her dad was in the junta, or is, you know, on the side
yes,
of.
Yeah,
she calls Latinos lazy and deeply offends Frank. And he basically just excuses himself after they've had a lovely dance.
Yep.
Because she's being, a horrible fascist racist cow.
She even says they got the buses running on time, which is just racist cliche.
It's
perfect, it's amazing,
isn't it? It's perfect.
Yeah.
Brilliant. It's a brilliant switch from she seems like the loveliest, wisest person to, oh my God, you're a monster. Mm. You're an actual monster. So she's discarded completely. We never see Carmen again. And then Frank is angry and he finds Alice in the corridor just sitting there feeling sorry for herself. And he's ascertained from Carmen that she's one of the dead letters. She's one of the women who wrote.
That's right.
And he launches into Alice because she's meddled in the lives of the people who are writing to, you know, who ended up at the office.
And he's probably a little bit pissed off that she's tried to set him up with a member of the Argentinian junta.
That was kind of a dumb error.
That doesn't go down well.
That's not really why he's angry, though. He's angry because he's confused, because he's having all these feelings. And that's when he tells a sobbing Alice, or he makes her cry by saying, "You don't understand what happened to my family." And basically, it's the junta sprayed his car with bullets. His wife got out, but his children bled to death.
Yes.
It doesn't pull any punches. It's like it's fully shocking. And quite an odd moment to put in the bit I've been waiting for since the start of the film. But, you know, we'll gloss over the fictional dead children. They kiss!
They do. So she's upset. She cries. And so he comforts her with a massive snog, basically.
He does, but tongues and ev. But then it's one of those tearful, emotional, we don't know what we're doing, we're just doing it snogs. Mm. And then they stop snogging and a comedically prattling woman comes to drag him away because he's needed to perform the twisty knot hanky dance thing in a special jacket. So he basically just sort of withdraws and she's left there kind of head spinning, tears running down her face, not understanding what's going on. He does the hanky dance. It's dead sexy.
He's not going to be able to dance properly after a snog like that. He had a slight limp.
He did have a slight... That's not nice, but yes, he did. And it's
well,
so
would have done.
So would you. She looked amazing.
Yeah.
And then it's sunset by the ocean. I think it's that she's clearly been up all night, or maybe it's sunrise the next day, and she's sitting on a bench, coat over her party gear, just sort of, you know, dazed, not knowing what to do.
Yes.
And then she phones in sick to work because she just can't face Frank, which is really sad. Meanwhile... men are moving into the office and taking away all the furniture. That's it. The dead letter office has had it. Things are being packed up. And then finally, when she does make it into the office, she comes to see Frank and she talks to him and sort of they've calmed things down again. There's no sexy tension. Well, no, the sexy tension never goes away, but like it's sort of the kind of the wine and the party and everything is all melted away and they're kind of just two people sitting in an office again, which is disappointing. Then she talks about... Oh, she tells him that she's Bundle of Joy. She tells him that they're her letters.
Yep.
So she confesses that. And the next thing you know, he's going to some caravan showroom. You're like, why is he buying a caravan? What's he doing? Like, he's about to lose his job. What's he going to do? Live in it and sell his house? I don't know.
Take the pigeon on holiday, maybe.
Exactly. Well, I mean, why not? Yeah. He's got nothing else to do now. And then it turns out he's asking after a man called Gerald Hartway. Who's Gerald Hartway? Wait a minute, Gerald's the name of her long-lost dad. It couldn't be the same one, could it?
It's got Hart in the surname. I mean, no, too much of a coincidence.
No idea. Anyway, so he's clearly on the hunt for her father, and it seems to be he's found him fairly easily.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next thing you know, Alice receives a letter. Her flatmate comes in and says, "Why don't you ever check the post?" and, like, hurls a letter at her. And it's addressed to Bundle of Joy, and she's like, "Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God." And it is the most... It's like she couldn't have dreamed a more perfect letter to arrive from her long-lost
father. Oh, absolutely,
It's so tender. Dearest daughter, it's saying everything you'd want to hear from your dad who'd not been around for 20-odd years. And he finishes it with, "In my arms, you will be safe forever." It's like, oh, my God, that's amazing.
Bloody
her dad's a good guy. He's a good guy. And he's just, it's a brilliant setup. He's such a good guy. He's everything she dreamed he would be. This is going to end happily. Great. Back at the office, everything's gone. All the letters have gone. All of the furniture's gone. It's just bare. And they talk of the coming of the computers, the evil computers that have now put them all out of a job, basically, because computers can now do what they used to do. So they're out of there. And then Frank sees Alice and she says, "I don't know." She says, "You found my dad, didn't you? He wrote to me." And he's like, "Yes, I did." And she's like, "You've got to tell me where he is." And obviously he can't really say no. So he pulls a business card out of his pocket and it's Frank's, you know, caravan sales business card. And he gives it to her. And she's like, "Great, I can go and see my dad." Meanwhile, a digger comes in and starts shoveling up all the letters. She's like, brutal. It's like, oh, they're all real people, man. It's like a real metaphor for like the progress of time and technology. It's just horrible. But anyway, so Frank has a box of his things. He's leaving. And the rest of the team are being redistributed to do other jobs. I think Mary's going to have to be a postwoman on a bicycle. She's like, "I can't ride a bike."
Yeah.
It's quite funny. And Frank gives the dead letter office door sign, or the kind of the office sign. He hands it to Kevin and says, "You're in charge." And he's like, "In charge of what?" And then he goes.
And the other one, of course, is that Peter, the seedy porn man, he's finally going to get his dream. He's off to Brizzy.
He's going to Brizzy, yeah.
Incidentally, do you know what the actor's called who plays Peter the Porn Man?
No.
Sid Brisbane.
He is not.
He is, honestly. Which, as well as being an in-joke, does also sound like a porn name.
It really does. Coincidentally, that's my porn name.
Your porn name is your father's middle name and where you're going to be relocated for work.
Yeah, no, actually, yes, it does. It works. It was amazing. Okay, so then we go back to Frank at home, and because he's released the story of his tragic past in Chile, it's almost like it's unlocked in him and he can feel those awful feelings. He's allowed them to come back in. And he lights 2 candles and props up the picture of his children in front of the store donkeys, but obviously acknowledging, like, there is a sadness. I do like candles. I can think about them now. So he's kind of almost, in a way, got his connection with his family back. And then Alice attempts to do the same thing, and she goes to the caravan showroom and is immediately jumped upon by Gerald, who tries to sell her a caravan. And she just, for a while, she just sort of lets him because she's, like, stunned. Just wasn't expecting him to suddenly be there after all this time. And I've just put in big letters, he is disappointing.
Yep, that's the word I used as well.
He's a bit of a loser. He's had 2 failed marriages, 2 lots of kids. He sort of does see the last lot, but he doesn't live near them anymore. And it's all a bit like, now I'm just here selling caravans. And it's brilliant. And do you know...
I do. I know what you're going to say. And yes, I do.
Damn it.
It's her dad.
You've done too much research. Yeah, no. So Barry Otto, I'm assuming he was quite a big deal in Australia, but they...
Yeah,
so
he
certainly
is.
Big in theatre. Yeah. They've done another thing together since as well. They've played father and daughter because there's, like, all these interviews with them on the internet. But so her real dad, Miranda Otto's real dad, plays Alice's long lost father. And he does play it brilliantly. And there's the one most poignant, awful line where he's sort of rabbiting a bit and he's a bit in shock too, obviously. And she's just stunned when he realises who he's sitting right next to in the very close confines of a caravan. So they're really near to each other. And he, after a while, says, look, don't buy this caravan. The suspension's, you know, fucked.
Yeah.
And she just looks at him like, wow, that's, like, literally the best you've got. You're going to save me. Because what you normally do is trick people into buying shit caravans.
Yeah.
I can't lie. I'm disappointed, her eyes seem to be saying.
Oh, absolutely. But also, I think the fact that, you know, he talks about that he was remarried. He's had other kids. So he has clearly moved on with his life, even though he's abandoned her.
Yeah.
And she's never managed to do that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of added
to
it.
No, and he still sees
yes,
his other kids.
That's right.
But he's never bothered to track her down, which presumably wouldn't have been that hard. You know, she's living with her mum and stuff. But yeah, so it's all very disappointing. Mm. And you can see in her eyes something has sunk in.
Yes.
Meanwhile, oh God, this bit real. This is where I start crying and I pretty much don't stop. I won't now, don't worry. but we cut to George in his back garden.
Do you mean Frank?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
His real name's George.
George is what I call him because we're together now. I wish. No, I don't. I love my husband. But so Frank, cut that out. So we cut to Frank in his back garden, which is vast. And he's standing next to the pigeon coop that he built for the pigeon. And a flock of pigeons is kind of murmurating above their heads. The strings are soaring. You know he's going to send the pigeon off to be with his family.
That's
oh,
right.
God, it's too much. So he releases the pigeon. The strings soar with the pigeon. It flies off into a happier future. And then we cut to Alice arriving at Frank's front door with a bunch of flowers. And it must be like the next day. I think she's wearing different clothes. And she says to him, he invites her inside. And she says to him, you wrote that letter, didn't you? And he looks kind of a bit like, oh, no, I didn't want you to know. But she's like, of course, the guy I just met didn't write that lovely thing about holding me in his arms when I was a baby and protecting me forever. But then she knows that the words were Frank's, not her dad's. OK, this is where it gets a bit Freudian and muddy, but let's pretend that that's fine. and they basically do this lovely kind of romantic reuniting scene where they don't say anything about loving each other or how they got here. They look to the future, they look to the mountains, and they do like a coin toss. Like, she's like, I might go travelling, might be nice to go with somebody else. He's like, well, you could go. And she's like, mountains or sea, heads or tails. And he tosses a coin, or she tosses a coin. He catches it, and says, heads. Obviously, it's the mountains, because the mountains have been this visual image of, you know, where he's from and where he belongs throughout the film.
Oh, yes.
And they decide to head off into the mountains together, kind of without saying it, and they snog, and it's epic, and it goes on for ages, and I loved it. And finally the headache starts to subside. I'm telling you, man, it's bad. And then the final scene is just really sweet. So that neither of them are wearing seatbelts because it's an old car, which troubled me. But apart from that, he's driving them towards the mountains, clearly to test his eyesight. I'm sorry, that joke just keeps coming up in this country. So she's writing to her mum. You can hear her in voiceover saying what she's writing. She's saying she got a job, lost a job, but she met a man who taught her how to salsa. She's learning Spanish and she's going travelling. And she says, buena suerte, mama. That means good luck.
Yeah.
The end. And the car just drives off towards the mountains. And, ah, they're together. She's talking about going back and studying again. The future is all hope and promise and potential, not misery and futility and how they started the film. It's just lovely.
Yeah, because earlier on, there's a voiceover, a letter to her mum where she's saying to her mum that you said I wouldn't amount to anything, that I've wasted my life, but you're wrong. So this bookends that very nicely. I've lost a job, but so what? My life is so much better.
Exactly, exactly. And it's just, it's a classic, you go looking for one thing and then you find another thing film. It's like, it's pretty straightforward and simple, but the relationship between those two people, I just massively invested in. And watching it again now, I still did. I thought, I might find it all a bit. There'll definitely be some tired old tropes that I'll go, oh, cringe. No, I think this stands up and I absolutely felt the same feelings. And I did cry at several points during it again. And bearing in mind, I watched it at like sort of 7:30 in the morning, a bit hungover. I mean, that's probably why. but it didn't disappoint. And I'm so glad I watched it again. So thank you, because it was lovely.
Excellent. Yeah, this is normally the point where I would say, I would ask our guest, Julia.
Julia, did you? Oh, sorry.
Is Dead Letter Office still any good?
OK, well, I'm going to build up the suspense a bit here before I answer. Yes.
You've shocked me.
I know. I'm so sorry. I've completely demolished the whole format of your thing.
That's all right.
But yes, no, it definitely stands up. I was really delighted to see it again. It's like an old friend.
Like I said, for me, it was the first time I'd ever seen it. And I agree. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed it. I thought
so
it was
lovely.
I'd almost call it like a, not patronisingly, but I'd say it's almost like a Sunday afternoon watch. Like you said, you watched it with a hangover. Watch it on TV with a duvet around you, a big mug of hot chockey or something, and just really get immersed in it.
Perhaps it's more sophisticated than we made it sound as well, but I think there are films from this. This is like 21 years ago I saw this. I was 23 when I saw it. I'm 44 now. And it's just, it's still got the integrity of it still intact. It's not like, oh, well, it looks a bit dated, but the core of it's still lovely. It's a film that could have been made this year, I think, in terms of not in haircuts, but no, not at all.
Yeah, there's nothing cringeworthy about it where you'd think like attitudes have changed since then. So you think, oh God, what? Oh,
yeah.
How did they ever let that happen? I know you're a big fan of Love Actually, and that's full of stuff like that. But
oh my goodness, let's not go there.
But you're absolutely right. I thought it was really, really charming. I thought it was very, very well written.
Yeah, so did I. So it was written by a woman called Deb Cox.
Deb Cox, who is the showrunner for the Miss Fisher murder mysteries.
That's how I understand.
Which is a great show.
So I looked her up. And it's really nice because the Little Misfit family in this film did go on and work with each other again. So Deb Cox then did a show called, what was it called? Sea Change, I think, which is a long-running show in Australia. Mm-hmm. And the woman who played Mary, whose name I obviously haven't written down, had a recurring role in that for 10 years on Australian TV. I'm going to, in my head, they were such a happy little family making this lovely film that they all stayed in touch and worked together again. But it does seem, the director didn't seem to do loads after this.
No.
I mean, a few things in Australia, but his CV is John Ruane. He doesn't seem to go much further beyond this in terms of IMDb anyway, but I'd be interested to know what he did after that, because really good direction, I thought, and lovely writing.
I think so too. I think it was intentionally slow moving, which is fine.
Oh, but I love slow moving. I loved Mad Men in a way that, because it took its time, I loved that. If it's done well, if the emotional journeys are believable and well paced, then I don't mind sitting and watching something unfold slowly. I like that.
I mean, I was never bored. It didn't feel like it dragged at any time.
It's a
nice efficient script, but liked the slow pace of it. I thought it was, really, really enjoyed it.
I'm so glad.
For something that I'd never even really heard of, it's good to find a little gem like that.
Well, obviously, I'd advise buying the DVD, but I mean, I don't know if you can. It is all on YouTube, which I know is not to be encouraged, but if you're curious and you want to see it, go and watch it on YouTube, because you found it. I didn't know it was available. I think I'd looked for the DVD years ago because it's something that pops into my brain every few years and I couldn't find it anywhere. But now there's quite a lot on the internet about it. So You can watch this if you wish to. It is lovely. Mm.
Which I would recommend. But if you are watching it on YouTube, which is a little bit naughty, just give $5 to charity or something and then you'll feel better about yourself.
That's a good idea. Yeah, definitely do that.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's probably about the end of it. Is there anything that you'd like to plug? I know you do a couple of rather excellent podcasts. Would you like to mention those?
Yes, please. I would love to. So because of lockdown and apparently having nothing to do, I do actually have a novel to finish, but you know, that's not getting done. I'm doing two podcasts. I have started series three of Always There, the Howard's Way podcast.
I know.
So that took a long time to get going again because I was just trying to do other things. But, you know, all bets are off now. And I basically did it because there's a brilliant writer in the UK called Sarah Phelps who adapts all the Agatha Christies for the BBC at the moment and has written the Dublin Murders and lots of other amazing things. And she is an unlikely fan of Always There, the Howard's Way podcast, and said, "Right, so when are you going to do some more?" And I was like, I'll do it again if you do an episode. And she has opened series three with the most astonishing two-parter. Her analysis is incredible.
I've listened to it. It's really, really good.
In the nicest way, that woman is a sewer when it comes to the human condition. She goes to the bad places and just digs, and I love her for it. So Always There, the Howard's Way podcast. And I also do a more general, slightly less niche one called The Box of Delights, which is just about any old TV, and they're 15 minutes long, so you can just pluck one and hear somebody talking about something they remember off of telly, and it's just very easy to just munch through a couple of those. So yeah, Box of Delights.
I'm a big fan of podcasts, and those two are ones that I do listen to a lot. Like I said, Always There, I've listened to every episode, partly because I do like the story unfolding.
Yes.
Also partly because you and the guests are just having such a good time. But also partly, which I think I've mentioned before, I used to live in Burselden.
Yes!
Which is, of course, where Howard's Way was filmed.
It's the mad thing. In fact, you were a competition winner, were you not?
I'm an award-winning songwriter, yes.
You are!
I won an Always There competition to write the lyrics to be sung over the top of the Howard's Way theme, which is something that happens every week with the guests on there.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, with your permission, I might sing it and stick it on the end of it. You don't have
That's
to listen to it. I'll go away and do it later because I can't remember the words, but I might stick it at the end of the podcast.
No, I would love that.
Because
yeah,
I like
do
to
it.
Sing. Being Welsh, I like to sing.
Actually, yes, I haven't heard you sing it, so that would be great. No, please do that. That would be delightful.
There you go. Good luck with that. Yeah, all right, that'll be fun. I always try and stick a little something at the end, so I might just do
Perfect.
That. I've had a glass of wine, so I might do.
Yay! God, I wish I was drunk. It's what time? It's 10 to 11 in the morning here, so, you know.
Yeah, because without showing off, I'm drinking, it's a very nice, as they call it, a cab sauv.
Lovely. Oh.
From a winery just down the road.
How lovely.
I've got two wineries within walking distance.
Of course
distance.
You
It's
have.
Quite nice here.
And Jacinda delivers your post and looks after your pets for you when you go on holiday, because where you live is perfect, and I'm jealous.
She does. She overfed the fish last time, to be fair, but I'll forgive her.
Only with kindness.
Yes. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us. I've really, really enjoyed it. It's been brilliant and love to have you back. When Rob has finally stopped being a father, that sounded horrible. When Rob stopped his parental leave, he's a little bit jealous that he couldn't be with us today. So we'd very much like to have you back on. If you ever wanted to choose another film, just say it.
I definitely would.
Because it's been such good fun.
Yes, please.
So as we end it, I always do a little bit of housekeeping so people can follow us. So if you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod, Instagram at StillAnyGood. We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood. If you wanted to email us, we're StillAnyGood@gmail.com. And please remember to rate and review us from wherever you get your podcasts. I think we're done.
Yay.
Thank you so much, Julia. Aww. That was awesome.
It was really fun. I'll stop this now, yes?
Yes, you can stop that now. We say our goodbye. So thank you, folks. See you soon. Bye.
It's outside Southampton, off the M27, at Junction 8. Just past Fareham I used to go, to Burselden Tesco, and see Chris Packham shopping, 'cause he was always there.